Welcome back to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. So joining us today is Diane Fugino, a longtime activist in the prison abolitionist and the free political prisoners movement. She's a professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and one of the editors of an important book on revolutionary Asian Pacific Islander organizing, Legacy to Liberation. But we have her on today to talk about her new book, Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you, Tammy. Thank you, Manuel, for having me.
We're really excited to have this book out. It's going to be opening this Sunday at the Japanese American Museum, but we'll give information about it at the end of the show. Yuri Kochiyama is an extraordinary woman and a revolutionary activist. Many know her from a very important date, February 21st, 1965, in the Audubon Ballroom when Yuri Kochiyama cradled Malcolm X in her arms as he died. Now, many remember her as that woman, but very few people know her life, or we think more people should know her life. So talk to us a little bit about Yuri Kochiyama in the sense of what are some important markers of her life?
Malcolm X is one of those important markers. He's her foremost political mentor, and he helped to radicalize. But I'm glad that you don't limit it to her, because so often when people think of Yuri Kochiyama, they always associate her with Malcolm X. But she also stands on her own as a historic figure in the Asian American movement, the Black Liberation movement, the political prisoner movement. She's done so much work in so many movements, it's really incredible. She was very active in community service extraordinarily, even before she became political. In her youth, growing up in San Pedro, during World War II, from inside the concentration camps, she and her Sunday school class wrote to some 13,000 Nisei soldiers. But after she became political in the 1960s, her work exploded and expanded and also became centered and grounded in the movements for social justice. So she worked initially as a civil rights activist for about a year or two, and when she met Malcolm X in 1963, she then began attending his organization of Afro-American Unity Liberation School, and that changed her views. And she moved from integrationism into self-determination and became what she identifies as a revolutionary nationalist. She worked with the Republic of New Africa as one form of moving towards black liberation. Once her friends began being targeted by COINTELPRO and locked up in prisons, she began to work very actively to support political prisoners. And she also worked in the Asian American movement for Japanese American redress, but also for ethnic studies. And she also worked with an important pan-Asian formation, Asian Americans for Action, in New York.
We had Yuri on Voices from the Frontlines last year, and I'm just thinking back, I asked her in one of our questions when I was emailing her, it was part of a long series, I said, do you consider yourself a revolutionary? And she answered, you know, there are many definitions of a revolutionary. She said, I don't consider myself a revolutionary. All my heroes are revolutionaries. People like Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Lolita Lebron, Rafael Cancel Miranda. And she said, Malcolm X said, a revolutionary is one who engages in revolution. He meant armed struggle. And she said, I've never been in armed struggle. I'm a grassroots political activist, a human rights activist. I believe in revolutionary thoughts. I feel the only real change will come through revolution. And she said, the main obstacle, the strongest detractor and enemy of those who want freedom and justice, is the United States. Here's a woman that is in every inch a revolutionary, but is very humble. She's an important person in terms of my own political development as having a revolutionary Asian Pacific American woman, as someone to actually have as an icon and someone whose footsteps you walk in. She was born in the early 20s. What are some of the important markers of her own political development? Like, how did her being in the concentration camps, how did that affect her awareness as an oppressed person inside the United States?
If I may comment on the first part of what you were saying, Rigoberta Menchu, in her autobiography, you know, from Guatemala, talks about how she made a decision to stay more above ground in working with people, but how she deeply respected those who worked underground in the armed struggle, and how difficult that life is to be underground in those ways and to be working in clandestinity. But she realized, in some ways, she felt that she wasn't doing enough because she chose to stay above ground. then she also realized that it takes all kinds of roles to be participating in these movements for social justice. And I think Yuri played the role that she really needed to play, that played on her strengths. So while she supported people and supported people who engaged in armed struggle and who believed in armed struggle, which is very controversial, especially after 9/11, her strength is really that of a networker, of bringing people together, of getting people excited and energized about the movement for social justice, of getting people to feel that they have a role to play, that they can contribute, there are things that they can do, of making people feel special, of letting people know about the various political prisoners and various movements, especially the radical movements for justice that most people don't know about. She played this role of really connecting up people and ideas and issues and information. And I think that that is part of who she is, part of her personality, to play that role. And had she gone underground, played a different role, I don't think she would have been as effective. And yet she, and I think she also, you mentioned that Yuri is very humble. She is the most humble person that I know. But I think she also is in awe of the folks who did participate in armed struggle, who took their organizing to a different level.
We're speaking with Diane Fugino. She just wrote an important book, Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama. And we're talking about the biography of Yuri Kochiyama. And I think one of the important things, Diane, is maybe she, in her humbleness, defined revolutionary in one aspect of what she saw. And I think that the scope of revolutionary activity and revolutionary organizers are very broad. It encompasses more than those who engage in armed struggle, and I think that's what we're marking, is she's a truly remarkable woman. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, in your introduction, you talked about choosing the title, Heartbeat of Struggle, as part of her involvement in the political prisoners movement. Can you talk about that story?
Sure. Yuri wrote in many of her speeches on political prisoners, she calls political prisoners the heartbeat of struggle. And she does that because she sees them as leaders in the community, as the people who've offered political leadership and a radical vision for social change, for fighting oppressive conditions, people who risk their own lives so that all of us could be free. And so she calls them the heartbeat of struggle. But yet when I spoke with many political prisoners, and as well as movement activists, they all see Yuri as the heartbeat of struggle, as a person who gives vitality to the movement, as a person who keeps the struggle going. And this was expressed to me by Mutulu Shakur, who's currently a political prisoner and was in the Republic of New Africa with Yuri. And Mutulu Shakur says that, you know, in the height of COINTELPRO efforts, the RNA in New York became very small. And there were a few people who were organizing to release, for example, the RNA 11, a political prisoner group, and doing the day-to-day work of the RNA. And many of the activists had gotten either incarcerated or killed or gone underground or in exile, or many were very intimidated to continue struggling in the movement, understandably, given the level of state repression. But Yuri kept going. In a very courageous way. And so he really saw her as somebody who, through thick and thin, continued in the struggle every day of her life and really helped to keep the movement going, to vitalize that movement. And so I wanted to call this book Heartbeat of Struggle.
Hey, Diane, this is Manuel Triollo. You know, one of the things that I think that it's really rich of what I can see from the book and what you're saying right now is the importance of, you know, conceptualizing Yuri's life and many of the revolutionaries as both revolutionary nationalists who are fighting for self-determination inside the United States. And one of the most frustrating things that I think that a lot of people in my generation have faced is that we've lost that concept in many ways. You know, we've sort of become a very divided, you know, identity, politics, that's the format of where we're primarily looking at our organizing, or very much within sort of the tracks of what the system provides for us. And we've lost almost that whole concept. You know, earlier we had Richard Moore talk about the legacy of Gorky Gonzalez. What has happened? I guess one is I want to commend you because you're writing a book about that. But secondly, why do you think that has been lost? Obviously, one, in academic circles. But second, why has it even been lost overall in the movement?
Yeah. Often academic circles and the kinds of thoughts that get and knowledge and theories that get created in academic circles reflect what's happening in society and in the movement, right? And, you know, I think that there's a lot of reasons why the really vital and vibrant and promising radical revolutionary movements of the 60s and early 70s didn't fulfill their promise or didn't end up continuing on in the path that we had hoped. One, obviously, and I think the Black Panther Party is an example of this. You know, one obviously has to do with state repression and the FBI's COINTELPRO program, as well as the police repression, undermined the movement in significant ways, taking out leadership, right? Neutralizing leadership, in the words of the FBI. I think we also see a rise in conservatism with 12 years of Reagan and Bush, and that's continuing on till today. In the 70s, we need to look at the economic situation of the United States, where after 1973 or so, we begin to see a major demise in the U.S. economy. It's no longer robust and growing. And we see the oil crisis that was happening then, as today, huh? A lack of expansive jobs were declining. Manufacturing was moving to the third world to make bigger profits for the owners of the corporations. And so for, I think, a multitude of reasons, the struggles, the conditions changed, and the struggles became harder to carry on and carry forth. And so I think that in a more conservative era, and also ideas about race changed. I think this is important also. In the civil rights era, people were fighting much more blatant forms of racism. And as a result of the civil rights movement and these other movements, Black liberation, Asian American, Chicano movements, ideas about race and racism have changed so that it's no longer acceptable by even the mainstream to be overtly racist. Racism has become covert. It's gone underground. So I think that the ways that people need to challenge racism has changed. Multiculturalism has become very in vogue and has pulled people, many people, into believing that there is no more racism, or racism is not much of a problem anymore, and it's something that can be addressed just through the establishment channel. And so I think it's changed the form of contestation at the same time. And so we see much more identity politics and much more reformist politics. But I know that there's a strong current of people who are still fighting, and they want radical change, meaning they want to get at the root of a problem. And when they make their analysis and see what's really causing oppression in society, like Yuri did, she would have labeled problems really imperialism and racism, along with that capitalism. And with that, she wanted to fundamentally transform society so that we can eliminate these sources of oppression rather than kind of putting Band-Aid solutions on, as we often are seeing today, as I think you articulate.
Well, we're winding down. I mean, I think one thing we'd like to know is, you know, there are a lot of us who, young organizers, actually almost any age, talking about burnout. We're losing a lot of people in the movement, some by their own choice. And here's a woman that's decided to stay in the movement some 50-plus years and is still active, even as her health declines and she's in her 80s, and she's still vibrant and strong. What's kept her going?
That's a good question, because Yuri is incredible in that way. She's one of the people who did not, and there actually are many people like this, we just don't hear about them and know them, who through thick and thin, through many life changes, you know, through having children, through health decline, through, you know, transformations in personal life, has continued to go. Yuri would say that the movement is contagious and the movement kept her going. And in some ways, I think that this is really true. After her husband passed away in 1993, she really was, it was very difficult for her in many ways. Obviously, they're almost 50 years together as a couple, but also he did so much concrete work for her to sustain her. But also, in some ways, you know, if we look at this dialectically, when he passed, she also felt freer in some ways to engage in the movement without having to take care of another person at the same time that he took care of her. After her stroke in 97, one of the things that kept Yuri going was the need to continue to struggle because there were people who had problems that who were suffering more than she. And also people in the movement gave her a lot of strength and emotional support. And so I think in many ways the movement does keep Yuri going, and this profound need that she feels to fight for justice and alignment and solidarity with those who are most oppressed and most suffering by conditions in society.
Well, I'm looking forward to this book coming out. It's going to be released this Sunday, April 24th at 11 a.m. at the Japanese American National Museum. The address is 369 East 1st Street. The telephone number there is 213-625-0414. And it's called The Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama. And one of the things that you wrote in the introduction is that it's an exploration of the dialectical relationship between social movements and the individuals who comprise the collective. And this was written over 3 years and how many interviews, Doc?
Almost 40 interviews, I believe.
It's 65 plus actual hours that were transcribed, and not to mention the endless notes that you've taken. So we're encouraging everyone to come out and support the book. You can get it online starting the 28th, but Yuri Kochiyama and Diane will be present at the Japanese American National Museum this Sunday. So we're encouraging everyone to go out. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. And we've got another 30 seconds. Anything else you want to close with, Diane?
I just want to say that Yuri's life is remarkable because in the struggle for justice, she teaches each of us to expand our own humanity. And she's been really a remarkable force in my life and in many people's lives.
Well, we look forward to seeing you Sunday.
Thank you so much, Tammy and Manuel.
Thanks, Diane. This is Tammy Bang Lu. We've been speaking with Diane Fujino on her new biography, Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama. We'll be right back with Christian Williams to talk about Our Enemies in Blue.